Revelation 5 is where we are today. Last week we were in Revelation 4 and we saw the visions, the strangeness of Revelation kind of begin in earnest. We saw John being pulled, being drawn upward into some sort of like deeper dimension of reality. It's like he goes back, we said last week, it's like he goes backstage of the entire universe. John has this vision of heaven. He sees the center of all reality. He sees the heart of everything, and it's not him. It's not him. He sees a throne at the center of the universe, and it's not his throne. It's not his. Someone else is sitting on it. Someone whom all of creation bows down to. The four living creatures worship him day and night. And then the people of God, the 24 elders, follow creation's lead. They bow down and worship to this God, to this one on the throne. Today, we're just going a little deeper. We're following John into this. If Revelation 4 reminds us, shows us, reveals to us, apocalypse, if it reveals to us that we are not on the throne, I think Revelation 5 wants to make sure we know who is on the throne. It wants to make sure that we know who is at the center of reality. So let's just read it. Here we go. Revelation 5. It's ancient, bizarre words. Let's just have a moment of recognizing the mystery that is before us. Revelation 5. Then I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll with writing on both sides and sealed with seven seals. If you need a visual aid, I've got one right here. In the right hand of him who sat on the throne, it's not me, but there was a scroll with writing on the inside and the outside, writing on both sides and sealed with seven seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, "Who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll?" But no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside. I wept and wept, because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll or look inside. Then one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals." Then I saw a lamb, looking as if it had been slain, standing at the center of the throne, encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. The lamb had seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. He went and took the scroll from the right hand of him who sat on the throne. And when he had taken it, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb. Each one had a harp, and they were holding golden bowls of incense, which are the prayers of God's people. And they sang a new song, saying, "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, because you were slain, and with your blood you purchased for God persons from every tribe and language and people and nation. You have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth." Then I looked, and I heard the voice of many angels, numbering thousands upon thousands, and 10,000 times 10,000. They encircled the throne and the living creatures and the elders. In a loud voice, they were saying, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise." Then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea. I think that covers everybody. And all that is in them saying, "To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be praise and honor and glory and power forever and ever." The four living creatures said, "Amen." And the elders fell down and worshiped. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So after Revelation 4, after the towering vision of like a throne at the center of the universe with someone sitting on it, John notices something. He notices something. He notices that way up there, in the right hand of the one, the mysterious someone. Have you noticed? It doesn't say like God says something. Someone is sitting on the throne in the hand of this mysterious someone who sits on the throne. Verse 1, there is a scroll. There's a scroll like the one we've got right here. It's a scroll. It turns out that this is a very important, not this one, but that this is a very important scroll in the book of Revelation. Seeing a scroll in somebody's hand, it probably wasn't terribly surprising. Scrolls were a bit like the equivalent of books or moleskin journals or three-ring binders even in the ancient world. I mean, scrolls are where you write stuff down. That's just what you do. You write stuff on a scroll. This one happens to have writing not only on the inside, if you looked, but on the outside as well. It's covered in writing. So what is this scroll? Verse 1 says there's a scroll in the right hand of the one who sits on the throne. What is in this scroll that John sees? You didn't miss anything. If you were paying attention and you're like, hey, I feel like I missed something. What exactly is that scroll? You didn't miss anything. John didn't tell us. He hasn't told us what it is. And this is the sort of thing that you could study a lot, and you could like get a dissertation, a PhD or something, writing about this scroll. Seriously, if you wanted to, probably you could do it. Some have speculated that this scroll is some kind of like legal document, a government document, you know, declaration, an executive order or something. A government document would fit quite nicely into the like government setting that we've got. We've got a throne room is where what John's seeing. Some have thought that this might be something like a last will and testament. You know, like a will. Somebody's died and they leave a will. That's especially interesting if you consider that under Roman law, you needed 6 witnesses to sign and then put their seals on your will. So you would write down your will, I want these things to happen after I die, and then you would get 6 friends to sign it, and then you would roll it up, and everyone would use a bit of hot wax just to let you know, if you want to make a visual aid on a Sunday morning, it's far trickier than you think to get hot wax to do this. They must have had different sorts of wax or candles or something. But you would get 6 friends to sign it, 6 friends to melt their wax and put their ring, their something, their unique stamp on this. And then, so everyone would have like a ring or a stamp or something unique. They'd make their own impression on this. And then, boom, you got it. It's like notarized. This is the ancient version of like making sure nobody, there's no funny business, nobody can tamper with this thing. You've added your own bit of wax to this, and boom, you got 7 seals on a will, on a last will and testament or something. That's an interesting idea that this might be. There might be tones of that, what John's seeing right here. Some have thought that this scroll might be the Old Testament. Maybe it's the Old Testament, like it's the Torah and the prophets and the writings. And that's why there's so much writing on it. There's so much writing front and back on this. It'd be a lot to fit on one scroll, but that happens to be the kind of scroll that we have. There's definitely tones, and there's a footnote in your notes today. They're definitely tones of the prophet Ezekiel, actually. This shares language with the prophet Ezekiel, what John's seeing right here. Whatever this scroll is, and we don't quite know yet. I've got my own best guess, and we're going to get there today. But whatever this scroll is, we don't quite know yet. You didn't miss anything, but whatever it is important. Maybe we could just start with that. Whatever it is, because we know it's important, because an angel, as soon as John sees it, an angel, this messenger, this heavenly sort of being, calls attention to it. He says, verse 2, who is worthy? Who is significant enough? Who is weighty enough? Who is capable? Who is fit? Who is worthy to break these bits of wax off of this scroll and to read it? Who is important enough to read this very, very important document? And apparently it's so important that no one, verse 3, no one anywhere, that's crazy. He's in heaven. You would think that there'd be somebody in heaven. No one anywhere in this entire epic throne room that he's got. No one in heaven or in the earth or under the earth. No one anywhere can open the scroll. It's too important. It's classified for your eyes only. You know, it's something. It's something. It's like so important. Nobody anywhere. And then John loses it. Loses it in the middle of, he has a breakdown, like a nervous breakdown, like a, he just, uncontrollable sobbing and weeping right in the middle of heaven. John's backstage of all of reality, but the world's still going on. We said last week that this probably is not a vision of heaven in the future. He's probably not been drawn into the future. It's like John's gone backstage of the world as it is right now. And that's why John seems to be weeping. It's not, there, all the tears have not been wiped away yet. John has still got loved ones in Ephesus and Pergamum and Smyrna, wherever. John's still got loved ones who are suffering. John's churches are still struggling. John's world is still full of like evil and darkness. Tears aren't gone yet. In fact, the tears and the weeping in the book of Revelation are going to have to increase before they get wiped away. It's like chemotherapy for the whole universe. The pain's going to get worse before it gets better. He starts, verse 4, he starts sobbing. He starts crying. This is an important document, evidently. He starts crying and weeping. He wept and wept because no one is able to open this scroll. Whatever this scroll is, it's not junk mail. You know what I mean? It's not coupons from Gordman's or an ad from Denny's. That's not what this thing is. Whatever this scroll is, it's important. You haven't missed anything. We haven't been told quite yet. We're going to have to figure out what this scroll is. But it is in the right hand of the mysterious someone at the center of the universe. It's got lots to say. It's written front and back, and it is perfectly sealed, hence the number 7. It's got 7 seals on it. And that, whatever all of that adds up to, it is enough to make John despair when he hears that no one will be able to read this. We're actually going to see this scroll a few more times. We're going to see it as we keep going in the book of Revelation. Next week, as chapter 6 of Revelation begins, we're going to start seeing some of the seals get broken, and the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse, perhaps you've heard of them, they start coming out of this scroll somehow when the seals start getting broken. In 3 weeks, when we start looking at chapter 10 of Revelation, we're going to see John being handed this scroll once it's completely open, and he's told to eat the scroll. Pardon me? That's right. In chapter 10, John goes all Ezekiel. He goes full-blooded Ezekiel on us, and he eats the scroll. You guys want to be here that day when I do visual aids on that. It's going to be, someone bring some ketchup. We're gonna be seeing this scroll a little bit more in the coming weeks. And we're never, I'll just let the cat out of the bag, we're never explicitly told what this scroll is. We have to kind of make a leap. We have to make a guess. We have to make an interpretation of what this scroll is. My best stab at it, along with lots of scholars, if we remember, John has been drawn into the backstage of all reality. He's been summoned into God's dimension so that he could see, what was the beginning of chapter 4? He said he was summoned so that he could see what must take place after all of this, after he had written his letters to... So, by all appearances, best we can tell, it seems like a really good guess, especially when we look at all of Revelation, not just this chapter, that this scroll contains, it tells us what must take place. It tells us, one scholar called it a scroll of destiny, is what one scholar called it. It's the scroll of destiny. This is the place. This is the scroll that has the answers. What answers, you ask? All of them. This is the scroll that's got all the answers. It's got answers to the questions that John is wondering about. Questions like, what does God have in store for his church? What does God have in store for all of creation? What's God planning on doing while my friends and family are suffering at the hands of the Roman governors or whatever? What are God's purposes in the world? How is God going to sort out all of history? In short, the sealed scroll, it begs a question. How does God save the world? Perhaps you've wondered this. Look around. Good grief. How is God going to save the world? I need some answers. Somebody tell me. There's no verse in Revelation that says the sealed scroll in God's right hand are God's plans to save the world. But hopefully it's going to become clearer over the next coming weeks as we explore Revelation that that's what this is. That's what this is. And that's why John is weeping. That's why John is weeping, because nobody can answer it. Nobody can answer the question of how is God going to sort out, how is God going to save the world? It seems like this scroll, if somebody could only read it, if somebody could only open it, we would find the future. We would discover God's plan for healing history, for healing your wounds, for healing your fears, for we would see God's plan. We would see God's strategy for sorting out everything. Injustice and hardship, for dealing with hurt and suffering, for making the way the end of the book of Revelation says it, God's plan for making everything new. God's plan for making everything new. Yeah, I guess the scroll's kind of important. Not only for the world at large, though it is important for... I would love somebody to have the answers for solving the civil war that's going on in Syria right now. Just untold amount of people dying. A refugee crisis that's flooding into Europe. And no, it's a complex thing with no easy answers. There's systematic, inhuman government oppression happening in North Korea and other places too, but North Korea, holy mackerel, it's unbelievable. Famine and food shortages all over the world. It would seem like this is an important scroll asking questions about those sorts of things. Slide two, just kind of asking the question like, is there a future that's good? You know what I mean? Is there a future? How can hurts be healed? Can anything be made? Forget Revelation promising. Can everything be made new? Can anything be made new? When we see news reports, kind of important answers that might be in this scroll for the world at large, but not only for the world at large, but I mean for us. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, our lives, all of our little stories are a part of the world's bigger story, you know? All of us live in this world, and we ask these questions not only of the world, but for us, right? I mean, is there a future? Like for me, for my family. I mean, how can there be a future when this thing has already happened in my life? Things have already gone from bad to worse. There doesn't seem to be any kind of solution that's showing itself in my life right now. What? How can there be a future when the cancer has come back? How can there be a future when my loved one died? Like, how could it happen? There's no way to undo that. They're dead. How can these hurts be healed? How can things be made new? We don't usually think about these questions, really. We don't really let them sink in on us, except maybe at a funeral or a wake or something. Those are the moments when these things flood over us. And most of the time, though, we just kind of distract ourselves away from these sorts of big, big questions. We don't ask them. We avoid them, if at all possible. We distract ourselves because, let's be honest, these questions are too heavy. They're too significant. We're not worthy. They're too hard. We can't open the scroll. We don't have a way of answering these questions. There doesn't seem to be anything or anyone in our lives that can make sense of the world at large or our lives individually who could answer these questions any way that doesn't ultimately lead to despair. If we really think about them, if we really consider them, if we really let the weight of them sink in, for big picture or even small pictures of our lives, we're likely to lose it too. Like John. We're likely to just, if we have a safe enough place, whether that's a broom closet or our bedroom or wherever, a broom closet, what kind of expression is that? If we have a safe enough place and we let these questions sink in, I think we weep and weep too. We weep and we weep too. But then, verse 5, something happens. One of the 24 elders says something. One of the two sets of 12 says something. One of the people of God says something. They say, "Do not weep." I think that's always the task of the church, is bringing hope to the hopeless. That's always the task of the elders of the church. Do not weep. Someone can make sense of the world, of history, of the future, of your lives, of your pain and suffering. The strong one, the lion of the tribe of Judah, the king from whom all kings grow. He's like the root of David. He has conquered. He's victorious. He's triumphed. He can do it. He can make sense of the world. He can bring hope. He can open the scroll. And so John, he looks to see this conqueror. He looks to see this strong one. He looks to see this lion. And he sees the most surprising of things: a lamb. He looks to see the lion, and he sees a lamb. A lamb looking as if it had been slain. Slain makes it sound kind of like a doctor's office, like it's very clean and sterile. The Greek's a bit messier than that. Joy's laughing because why is a lamb in a doctor's office being killed? Anyway, sorry. I don't know why you're laughing, but it sounds a little sterile, the language that gets translated right there. The Greek's a little messier. It actually says it's looking as if it had been slaughtered. Looks as if it's just been slaughtered. That sounds a bit messier, doesn't it? And that's the picture. That's the picture. This lamb has been slaughtered. It's been violently killed. It's been butchered. This lamb is slaughtered but still standing. Slaughtered, but still standing. And it's a strange, I mean, anybody else, this is why we study the book of Revelation, but anyone else, this is a strange-sounding lamb, not just because he's been slaughtered and he's still standing, but he sounds a bit like a radioactive kind of lamb, you know? So it's like he's been exposed to whatever the Hulk was exposed to. He's got, verse 6, he's got 7 horns and 7 eyes. And this is where we begin realizing, if we hadn't before, the numbers and the images are symbolic in Revelation. They're not literal. This is a genre, apocalyptic literature. Eyes are like the symbol of seeing, of perception, of knowledge, of knowing something. Horns, I mean, you've seen a bull, right? Horns, or a ram or something, horns are a symbol, a picture of like vitality, of strength. And he's got 7 of each, is what this lamb has. He's got 7 of each. This lamb is perfectly knowledgeable and perfectly strong, is what the images convey. That's what the images convey. It's a strange-sounding lamb sharing the center of heaven, isn't it? It's a strange-sounding lamb sharing the center of heaven, the place where only God should be. That's where the lamb is. That's where the lamb is. He's at the center of the throne. Central to the confession of the church is that God has made himself known in Jesus. You want to know what God is like? You look at the lamb. He's at the center of the throne. God is not forever a mystery. The one who sits on the throne does not just stay this mysterious someone. God is not forever. The throne is not forever in a fog. It's not the mysterious someone who sits on the throne has revealed what he's like. Apocalypse! Peekaboo! This is what I'm like. I'm like a lamb that has been slain. God, if you want to know what God is like, the church says it's really good news. God is a giver. He's always, this is what we heard in chapter 4. It was the song of chapter 4. God's a giver. He's always giving life and existence to everything. God is a lover. God is a lover to the point of pain, to the point of suffering, to the point of slaughter. God is God's a servant. God is a servant to the point of death. Even death on a cross, as Philippians says. And if you want to work with the grain of the universe, if you want your life to line up with the center of reality, you will be a giver too. You will be a lover too. You will be a servant too. Because otherwise, you're out of orbit. You're headed towards a black hole. You're not running with the grain of the universe. The reason why everybody in heaven, and the scene just starts getting bigger and bigger as we head further into chapter 5, the reason why everybody gives praise and honor and glory and power to the one at the center of the throne, why the 4 living creatures and the 24 elders in verse 9, all of creation and all of God's people, why they're bowing down and praising and worshiping him. Why the scene just gets stupidly big, mind-boggling big. The circles around the throne keep growing and growing with 10,000 times 10,000 people in verses 11 through 14, worshiping. The reason why everybody is worshiping the center of the universe, why everyone's worshiping the Lamb at the center on the throne, is because there is where we find the most beautiful. where we find the most good, where we find the most compelling. That's where we find the thing that is what makes sense of the entire universe. Slide 3. I think in the Lamb, what we end up finding is we find a God who makes everything new by healing it from the inside, is really what we end up finding. We find a God who heals, who rescues, who saves, and he does it from the inside, is what he does. I'm not sure that all of us, any of us, ever can rationally, can intellectually, can cognitively, like, make sense of the world, of the suffering that we see in Syria or refugee crisis or North Korea or cancer coming back or my loved one dying. I'm not sure any of us can make sense of any of those things on an intellectual level, of all the suffering we see. A lot of times there's so much pain, there's so much suffering, there's so much slaughter that we see in the world that it's impossible to make sense of it on an intellectual level. And I think that's why the gospel, the witness of the church, what one of the elders is pointing to, the good news is always asking us to trust on a relational level, not on an intellectual level. The church is always asking, will you trust the Lamb? That Lamb who's slain. I know you can't make sense of your world. I know you can't make sense of your life. But will you look at the Lamb? The Lamb who's slain, will you look at him and will you trust him? God is not disinterested in your life. He's not detached from the world. He's not far from you. He's not far from you. God saves the world from the inside. God, we're invited to trust the God who has felt every pain. He's chosen to feel it. He knows our every weakness. He's experienced every temptation. In fact, he suffocated in our sin. That's what the gospel proclaims. He had to go that deeply inside. That's what God is like. He goes that deeply. He plunges into the worst pain of your life. He sinks into the grossest injustices in all of history. He suffers the deepest of tragedies to heal it from the inside. To heal it from the inside. And after absorbing all of the slaughter, he's still standing. He's still standing. The question for us is, will we trust the God who heals from the inside? That's what God's conquering looks like in the book of Revelation and in all of our lives. That's what God's victory looks like. I think if we were to get honest, a lot of my struggles with the life of faith, they come because I'm looking for a different kind of victory than this. I'm looking for a different kind of conquering than this. A lot of times I wish that God would just come and make sense of my life like a lion leaping from the underbrush. I wish that God would just charge out and he'd use his 7 horns and his 7 eyes, his perfect power and his perfect knowledge. I wish he would just override whatever's going on in my life. I wish that he would just overpower everything that goes on in my life, my circumstances. I wish that he would just deliver like a death blow to my enemies. I wish that he would just, like, arm wrestle everything in my life into compliance. And I wish that he would do that in the world, too. I think we wish that God would just quickly, God, just fix everything from the outside. Just do it. But that's not how God works. That's not how God works. That's not what the life of faith looks like. That's not what God's victory looks like. We hear, verse 5, we hear that the lion has conquered, but what we actually see is the lamb slaughtered. That's what we actually see. God uses his knowledge. God's knowledge is better than ours, and God uses his power in a better way than we use our power. He uses his power to get inside and to slowly, patiently, painfully heal and transform and save. Evidently, salvation, the only way that you can do it, he's perfectly knowledgeable. Evidently, if you want to save, you have to save from the inside out. If God wants to save the world, which the gospel says he does, if God wants to save us, which it says that he does, he has to do it from the inside. It's not going to be quick from the outside. It's going to be slow and patient and painful from within. The Lamb on the throne is like unspeakably good news. It's good news. God is he's a lover. He's a giver. He's a servant. But it also challenges, I think, and this will bring us to the table. It challenges like everything, I think every area of our lives. Because throughout our lives, I think, in every area, we want victory. We want conquering. We want it proud, and we want it immediate, and we want it obvious. And we want it painless too. Please, give it to us painlessly too. We want to conquer like lions. It's what we want to do in every area of our lives. But the victory of the lion only comes through the serving of the lamb. You got to serve like the lamb. You got to surrender like the lamb. I would dare to venture you have to suffer like the lamb if you want victory. Serving, surrender, suffering. Real popular words these days, right? It doesn't feel like victory at all, but Jesus assures us that it is. The Lamb on the throne, it challenges us that path, whatever it is in your life right now, that path that looks like weakness, that looks like absurdity, that looks like a dead end, that looks like a bloody mess, it might just be the truest path of healing and hope and conquering. If I don't say anything right now, they will think that they've won. Maybe they'll think that. Maybe they'll think that. If I surrender, if I choose to serve that person, if I don't tear into the situation like a lion, if I don't use my strength to overrule and overpower, breaking bones and roaring my opinions, nothing is ever going to change. Are you sure? Are you sure that's the path to victory? If I got vulnerable, if I let those around me know how deeply I am struggling with my marriage, with my doubts about everything, with fear, with anger, with bitterness, with hidden weeping, that doesn't feel like a move towards victory. It doesn't feel like a move towards conquering. That feels like going deeper into darkness. Maybe it is. Maybe it is. But that's where the Lamb always goes. That's the good news. That's where the Lamb always goes. Deep, deep, deep. The Lamb goes into the heart of darkness to shine light, to bring resurrection, to heal. So may we bring our hard questions that seem unanswerable. May we bring those hard questions to the throne, and never hide their heaviness or hide our weeping. May we hear the witness of the church telling us, do not weep. There is hope. May we trust the Lamb who heals from the inside and follow him on the frequently painful path of surrender and servanthood and the song of victory.